Lord, the stuff we're going to talk about today is hard. It's enduring, it's difficult, there aren't easy solutions, Lord, and sometimes we can feel powerless and hopeless. And Lord, I pray for the people in this room who have maybe loved ones or people in their sphere of influence, Lord, that are struggling, and I pray for them, Lord. I pray that you give them strength and courage and wisdom and support as they are the hands and feet of Jesus. We thank you for Mount Hermon and their willingness to just go there about difficult things. Thank you for the opportunity, Lord, to share. And I just give you this hour. It's in your name. Amen. Okay. Before we get started, I want to kind of focus. Man, the whole Miller family is here. Oh, my gosh. We just need two more and we're good. Sorry, I'm distracted. Before we start talking details and information, I just want to read Psalm 23. I think it's a really good way for us to get a visual picture of the stuff we're dealing with. So if you feel comfortable, close your eyes. I'm just going to kind of read it to kind of settle us before we jump into some hard information. Okay. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. It's good to slow down and remember that God is in the darkness. He's with us when we're in those valleys. Because we may not feel him, we may not see what he is doing in these struggles, but we need to reorient our brain to remember what we know intellectually is true, but we may be struggling emotionally to see and experience. Okay. So before I talk about these specific issues, I want you to have a sense of teenagers, because they're in a unique stage of life. And even though they may look like grown-ups, their insides are different. Their brain is different. The things that they need to accomplish as teenagers to get to adulthood are affecting things. And so it's good to have kind of this context before we jump in. In each stage of development, there are what's called developmental tasks. It's developmental theory, what it says, like, okay, we need to learn how to tie our shoes. That's a certain stage that they are able to learn that, and they take those skills and use them in the next step. It's like we learn to read first before we read to learn, right? So teenagers also have developmental tasks that are really important. And the first most important one is identity. It's the who am I question. And this is why I love working with this age group. Because to me, who we are is the most important question we can ask. Who is God and who am I? And so they're trying to figure that out. And they tend to be kind of messy when they're figuring that out. But this is a really important thing that they're trying to discover for themselves. And they do this through risk taking. They are risk takers. Think opposition and transition. They have to kind of figure out who they are, and they do that through trying stuff out. And the visual that I like to use to help describe this part of their lives is like if you picture a daisy, and the inside of the daisy is home, let's say. And their developmental path to figuring out and collecting information is they're tracing the petal of that daisy. They're going out, they're collecting information, they're seeing things, they're doing things, and then they're taking that information back to home. And then they go, is this me? Is this not me? I wore these jeans last week. Is this the right? They're synthesizing. They're assimilating and accommodating this information. And home, we want to be stable like the center of a daisy. When it's not a stable place, they're still doing that path, but there's no rest. Does that make sense? They're just kind of spinning. So that stage is really important for them to figure out who they are. And they tend to then not, they're a little bit more suspicious of adults. They're more, you got to kind of earn my respect. You got to earn that I can talk to you about things. And so that's part of this this transition that they're in. And there's this neurological basis to their risk-taking. Their brains are at a critical stage where they're very influenced, they're very sensitive to dopamine influence. That's part of learning, right? So that's also going on in the brain, that they're sensitive to what dopamine is doing. As for rewards, dopamine is part of rewards, it's a part of learning, it's a part of decision-making, and it's at its peak. So the next phase, next developmental task is autonomy. They have to be different. I've heard the definition of, like, what is adolescence? I've heard it begins in biology and ends in culture. That's just one that's easy to kind of say about this stage. And they are wanting to figure out who they are apart from mom and dad, but they also want to have attachment to their family. And they're trying to figure out how to do these two things. Because my guess is that mom and dad may say, here's who we are, this is what good decision making looks like. And they're like, but yeah, I kind of want to just see if I can do it. I bet I could pull it. I mean, I know they said this, but so they're kind of in this autonomous place trying to figure out who they are. And what tends to happen is they tend to lie, they might minimize, they might keep some secrets, and just know that's a part of every teenager. Right? It's just them trying to balance these two things, autonomy and also staying attached and have a good relationship, because they need that center of the daisy, right? So they're trying to figure that out. Okay, peer relationship skills, another really important developmental task. These are crucial skills to have in adulthood that they're trying to figure out. Conflict resolution, how do I tell people I'm not okay? How do I communicate? How do I have healthy boundaries? How do I manage my emotion in all of this? Because it seems like they're just all over the place, right? They're just, woo, feels like a lot. And so they are trying to work out all of those skills and how they relate to their peers, how they relate to the opposite sex. And we need to still do this in adulthood, right? So there's this phase that becomes really important for them to try to figure out. The last developmental task is the formal operation skills. What's happening in the world? What is my role in the world? How do I make it better? How do I participate? And they're now just in this phase to think abstractly and critically, and they're able to analyze, and it's fully developed at that point. And some, you know, with these tasks, everyone's going to do this at different speeds. Okay, so I'm just being really general so that you can know that this is just a part of what they're trying to figure out. And so they're able to hypothesize and engage in critical thinking at this phase. So those are the four developmental tasks that are really important for kids to be able to get through. So what's happening in the brain? It's kind of nuts. Like, I hit this at 12. Really uncomfortable, let me tell you. But then, what's crazy is our brains are not done being fully cooked until your late 20s, early 30s. Like, I had another 15 years to, like, have everything work up here. It's kind of crazy. No wonder why they don't always make the best decisions, right? But then you think, culturally, people are getting married at 14, 15, 16. Like, how did they make that work? I don't know. I have questions. But that's important to know, that their brains are being fully developed, slowly. And then after that, guys, it's just like, whoop, get out your Sudoku, people, because we're just, you know, our brain is now slowly deteriorating. It hits its peak, and then, you know, we got to work it to use it so that it doesn't lose its faculties. So what's also happening in the brain, too, is so when children are little, their dendrites are just, imagine like a tree with lots of little branches. They're all over the place, right? And so their thinking is not very fast because there's all these ways for that to get to the other point of their brain that they need to get. Whereas in adolescence, they're pruning. So they're pruning the pathways that are not being used. And then those places in the brain that are being influenced are the ones that are going to be the superhighway, so to speak. Does that make sense? It's like where they're cutting off all the side streets. So the brain is faster, which means that the brain is highly influenceable at this phase, which is great if you make good choices. But if you're not making great choices, it has a larger impact. So a person who decides to use substances as an adolescent, that's going to affect their brain more than if they decided to wait until their mid-30s, right? Does that make sense? So, and the way the brain grows is it starts back here and it grows forward. Well, the front part of our brain is so important. It's called the prefrontal cortex, and it helps us do so many important things. It's that where the executive functioning is. It helps with decision-making and emotional processing, how we plan and organize, delayed gratification, you know, response inhibition, like maybe we shouldn't go do that, right? Maybe we should slow down and take in some information before we jump off this cliff. So that's kind of in its end phases in the late 20s, early 30s as well. Okay, so our brains are highly sensitive at this stage and not fully developed. And so it's important to know that that influences how they make decisions, how they manage their emotion. It's not their teens are up and down, and there are good reasons for that, because they're trying to manage all these things they're supposed to do, and then their brain isn't done. And then you throw in a lot of other things. It makes it really difficult for kids. Okay, so I'm going to try to tackle three subjects that are monumental in a really short amount of time. And so I'm going to just tell you certain things. I could spend weeks on one thing, but I'm just going to try to give you some little nuggets of things, okay? So let's move into substances. And I'm mainly going to talk about alcohol and pot use, since those seem to be the two that are the most used. So teens with alcohol, they statistically drink more dangerously than adults. They drink less often, but they drink much more, right? So they tend to binge drink. And a binge, what is a binge? How do we quantify a binge? Well, a binge for a woman is 4 drinks within a 2-hour period. A binge for a man is 5 drinks within a 2-hour period. And if you know teens, they get the party started with shots and they've already binged after 4. And then they go into something else that they're doing. So they're really diving deep in how it affects their brain and their ability to do all kinds of things. One little other thing I want to say about alcohol, which I found really fascinating reading a book, it was just like a little side note, but that I thought it was really interesting. This is an old research, but it's 2001, and what they found was that kids who are children of alcoholics are 4 times likely at risk to also develop problems with substances. And this was true even for kids who were adopted out of the home. So they were able to see that it was a genetic influence. And what they discovered was that they coined these kids alcohol naive, which meant that they reported less intoxication, less impairment in cognitive and psychomotor impact than was actually true. Does that make sense? So they weren't able to self-assess how drunk they really were. Now imagine how that could really play into drinking more, driving, right? You're going to make choices based on your perception of yourself. And if you think you're okay, then you're going to not make good choices. So isn't that interesting how the brain can impact so much those decisions? And when I work with young people, you know, I really try to ask, like, what's your family history? Because you may think this is just fun to go out and hang out with friends on the weekend, but it may be really difficult for you to pull out of this phase of life if it's just recreational substance use. And they kind of hear that, to be honest. You know, but I try to let them know that this is something they need to be cautious of. But that's in the future, right? I'll let my future self deal with that, Alita. I was like, okay, well, at least you have the information. Okay, so let's talk about marijuana use. It's the most common drug now being used by teens. I've seen definitely in my own little world that pot is preferred over alcohol. I don't know what that is. Maybe because it's on every street corner in Santa Cruz right now, where you just have to be 18 and I get headaches sometimes, but I would say that that's true. But kids who use substances under the age of 12 are much more likely to have mental health issues later. So I look at that statistic and I go, probably they already had stuff going on at 12 to want to go, this is how I'm going to fix it. So maybe it didn't just show its face until later. Sometimes stats, you know, you have to kind of go, what does that mean? So using substances, they've said, can lead to depression, but my guess is that there's already stuff beforehand, and that can increase that for them, that's already present. So what are intoxication symptoms? These are just immediately after use. What's important to know is that even if you have one hit of marijuana, that will stay in your system for a month after. So drug testing can be very difficult. If that was ever an issue for family members or whatnot, they could have done it a month ago, right? And it still will show up in a pee test. So it's just important to know. Okay, so what happens? Well, your motion control is impaired. You feel some euphoria. You have a sense of everything slows down. Your judgment is influenced. Dry mouth, increased appetite, rapid heart rate. Those are all symptoms of just kind of more of the immediate impact. What do withdrawal symptoms look like? This is important to know if you have a kid who is using substances and you like go, what's up? Well, I can kind of tell something's happening. Well, this will help you. So they tend to be agitated, angry, irritable. I mean, they just were in happy land and now it's gone, and they might feel more irritable and angry and impulsive and frustrated. Sleep disturbances can come. Nervousness and anxiety can be a part of kind of coming out of that. You know, it kind of slows everything down, but now they're having to re-experience what their brain was maybe doing before. Concentration problems, and it may affect their appetite. And so you might know kids probably who've already maybe attempted trying any of these substances. And I want you to be able to know, what does that mean? What happens if you find pot in your kid's underwear drawer? Like, okay, what does this mean, Alita? Because there's a range of use to addiction. And so I would like you to kind of have this as a way to kind of help understand what is going on with your kid's choices around substances. So the first least in, amount that is being used is what would be called experimental. So they try it at one time. It's like going to Trader Joe's and they, churros? I'm gonna try churros. And then you go, no, I don't really like churros. So this is kind of a try it out sort of a thing. That's on the use abuse continuum. The next is social recreational. So this is around, and this is true for anyone who uses substances, right? We're a society that says it's the 4th of July, and so that involves substances. And so that would be a social, recreational sort of decision. So it's revolved around being with other people. It's involved around special events. One more step towards addiction would be habitual use. Habitual use sounds just like, what's a habit? It's something that's a part of your consistent routine. Maybe it's a daily thing. Maybe it's a habitual, could probably maybe even be 3 or 4 times. It could be, but it's more than recreational. So does that make sense? And then what's more than that? Then it would be abuse. So then it's habitual, but it's in large amounts, right? So they're using it habitually and they're partaking in more than they would have prior. And then the end of the continuum would be addiction. And what are addiction symptoms? Well, addiction is that you crave for that substance. Your body craves that, your brain craves that effect that happens after you take the substance. Life becomes more unmanageable. It starts to unravel your relationships. You may be showing up late to work. You're not paying your bills. Your life kind of starts to come unraveled. And you continue this use even though you have negative consequences. That's a big one. You're still doing this even though your spouse left you, or you got kicked out of school, or you got a DUI. Like, for us who don't struggle with addiction, if we do something and it has a pretty big consequence, we're like, whoa, course correct. That was not a good, oops, right? We kind of go, how do I make sure that doesn't happen? The addict continues on. And for people who have people who are addicts in their life, it doesn't make sense. Like, why don't you just stop? They're not able to. You're preoccupied with the drug. There's loss of control. There's distorted thinking, denial. You minimize things. You rationalize things. There's physical dependency. There's withdrawal symptoms. And then there's this tolerance that says, your body just needs more to get the same effect. So those are all symptoms around addiction. Okay, I know, I'm moving on. It's nuts. Okay, so let's go to self-injury. Let me give you a definition that I heard in a class that I took. I thought it was really good. I'll read it a couple times if you want to write it down. It's a behavior involving deliberate, self-inflicted, low-lethal bodily harm. So that's a behavior involving deliberate, self-inflicted, low-lethal bodily harm of a socially unacceptable nature, performed to reduce stress without the intent to die. So it's socially, it's not something that their culture will say is a good idea, and they do it to reduce stress. Do you guys get that? Sure. A behavior involving deliberate, self-inflicted, low-lethal bodily harm of a socially unacceptable nature performed to reduce stress without the intent to die. So what this is it's habit forming. Self-harm is habit forming because it affects the brain. It's what's called a process addiction. So again, even if you have someone in your life who has self-harmed, it may be an experiment, one time, two times, three times. But what's important to know is that self-injury does affect the dopamine levels. There is an endorphin rush. That's why people do it. It like works. It seems so counter, right? Why would you hurt yourself to feel better? But it works. And it affects the brain just as much as a substance. I mean, so process addictions are like gambling, right? There's sex addiction. I put eating in self-harm addiction as well. So things that you can do behaviorally that affect your brain just like taking a drug. I mean, that's so crazy that that can happen, but we're fearfully and wonderfully made, right? Like, maybe we didn't need that part of our brain. I don't know. We'll figure that out when we get to heaven, right? Okay, so there's different types. Well, let's see. Okay, I went to methods. So different methods of self-harm: cutting, burning, hitting, biting. High-risk behaviors can be. It just depends on intent. So it's just because someone makes a certain decision doesn't necessarily mean it's a self-injury sort of a thing. Skin picking, hair pulling, and like I said, eating disorders can be a part of that. And now there's two different kinds. There's non-dissociative and dissociative. So non-dissociative, in my experience, that doesn't continue very long. So non-dissociative means that they're more fully present with what they're doing. They don't kind of check out and go somewhere else when they self-harm. In my experience, they feel the pain more, the actual physical pain of hurting themselves, where the dissociative is just not even in their body. The dissociative one is what I kind of want to spend a little bit more time on. And again, there's an endorphin rush that happens. It only lasts for a short time. It's like a hit. But your brain starts to crave that as a relief to the things that they're struggling with. So risk factors, let's talk about that. Feeling powerless is a big one. Feeling really stuck. Because you got to remember, this is an attempt to solve a problem. They want to fix something. Now, there are those few who are suicidal and self-harm, and that's kind of a different category, and I'm not going to really talk about that. But generally, people are self-harming because they're trying to do something. They don't want to take their life. They just want to take care of their pain. Well, I guess that's true, too, of them. Anyway, we'll keep going. Okay, so another thing is that they're emotionally isolated. they lack peer validation. They're on their own, and their family tends to be emotionally invalidating. So they don't have a home where they can say, I'm not okay, that they can talk about how they feel. They don't really feel safe. And it might even be a conflict avoidance sort of a home where we don't talk about struggles. And there's also this high level of pressure that can be a part of that. So you have a home where there's high levels of pressure. We don't talk about how we feel. We avoid conflict. What do you do? The feels come whether you want them or not, as my daughter says. The feels. The feels were big today, Mom. You know. So they're going to happen because stuff happens in life and it's hard. So they don't learn those tools that they need to deal with that. And so self-harm becomes a way to deal with that. Okay, let's see what else. They have difficulty communicating how they feel. They don't have a lot of coping strategies or self-care, self-soothing strategies. And they might expect a lot of themselves, real high-achieving sort of a kid. And they could have a history of abuse in one way or another. That definitely adds to the risk factors that are happening. But why? Why would you do this, Alita? It doesn't make sense. Well, it's a number of things. Again, they're trying to fix something. It might be to punish themselves for their perceived faults. They're not perfect. See, I blew it again. Now I need to pay. So they might be punishing themselves. Another reason may be that they're trying to relieve overwhelming pain. They feel too much. They're ready to explode and they need a release. Or the opposite. They might feel nothing. They might feel numb. And they're just trying to feel something. They're just trying to be in their body because they're just somewhere else all the time. Or they're just trying to have a sense of control in their life. They feel out of control. And they want to have mastery over something. So I'm going to do this to my body, and that means I can do something because I feel so powerless and overwhelmed. Or it's just to express how horrible they feel. They might want to just let people know this is an external expression of what's going on inside. So sign and symptoms to try to pay attention to. Well, pay attention to scars and fresh cuts and bruises, especially if they're at different stages of healing, something to pay attention to. My big red flag when I have someone come into my office, because we have fog here and it's cold, is they, you know, it's a hot day and they have long sleeves and pants on. And I just go, what? Okay. Well, maybe that's a thing. It's not for sure. Maybe they just don't feel comfortable in their body for another reason. But when it just doesn't make sense, it's like 110 and you're like, hoodie and jeans? Really? Okay. Well, just something, right? It may be nothing, but that's something that I've seen. Let's see. They might just avoid situations to show their body, especially if it's like something they really enjoy. Like their best friend's having a pool party and they're like, yeah, I'd rather not go. Okay, pay attention to that. They might avoid sleepovers. Another sign is that just emotionally they're not very stable. They might be impulsive and unpredictable, but feeling statements of hopelessness, helplessness, and worthlessness are indicators to a lot of things, but that's can be part of it. Okay, so now I'm going to move to suicide. I know, I told you. It's a red flag. Okay. So sadly, it's considered the second leading cause of death right now for 10 to 24-year-olds. Isn't that such a bummer? It's so preventable, too. 4 out of 5 teens, thankfully, give warning signs. That's what's really good, is they'll let you know. And about 5,200 junior high and high school kids will attempt daily nationally right now. So, but let's talk about myths. Let's just debunk, because it's scary, right? You just kind of go, whoa, that's a little, I don't know how to deal with that. But I want to kind of debunk some things so you can kind of know how to help. So people who talk about suicide won't really do it. Well, that's not true. Almost everyone who attempts or completes suicide has said something or done something to indicate that they're not okay. And so even if they're joking, we want to pay attention to that. The next myth is that if a person is determined to kill themselves, well, there's nothing I can really do about that. That's also not true. basically a person, the most serious person is wavering. I just think it's so counter to who God's made us to be. There's so much evil in these moments where they're just so dark that they want a way out. They want pain to stop, but they see this as the only solution. So really they want the pain to stop. And talking about it, giving people an opportunity to talk will help them see that there's other ways to solve it, which is the second or the third myth is that talking about suicide will give someone an idea. Generally, do not give depressed people ideas. They're all in their head all of the time, and they're just thinking. And so you break into their world and say, how are you? What's going on? I'm a little nervous. Have you ever thought about harming yourself? We'll talk about what to do. But someone's here. It's like they're on an island all by themselves with the devil, and they're isolated and alone, and you talking to them is giving them a way off the island. The last common myth is that people who attempt suicide and don't complete suicide are just trying to get attention and aren't serious. Well, it may be a cry for help. And there may be ulterior motives, but I do believe that we need to take all of that seriously. Because they're not okay, clearly, for whatever reason. And so we need to take all of those attempts seriously, take their words seriously. Their words, we want them to know their words matter. Now, what you end up doing about it might depend on a lot of things, right? But you want to say, I hear you, I'm present, I care, let's do something about that. Okay, risk factors. Well, if you have mental health struggles, you're more likely to take your life. My brother struggles with mental health issues, and he's struggled his whole life. And so that just adds to the complication. Or if you use substances, that increases that as well. It's a risk factor. Chronic pain, serious chronic pain, I think, is another risk factor. Prolonged stress, you know, people who've been harassed or bullied, we can see that. They struggle and they find death as an option for them. If you have accessibility to lethal means, that's a risk factor. If there are guns in the home or there's drugs in the home, an impulsive decision can happen. Exposure to someone else's suicide increases. Or if you have family members who have taken their own life, that increases your likelihood. Or exposure to graphic pictures, sensationalized acts of suicide. You know, I say this every time, but I really just want to shut down 13 Reasons Why, that dumb Netflix show. Just think, really, do we need that content out there? I think we can talk about suicide differently. So those are risk factors to suicide. So what are some warning signs? Well, they might be talking about feeling really burdened and in a lot of pain. They might say, I don't really have a reason to live. They might say, we talked about college, but I don't know, Mom, I don't really wanna, I'm done. I'll just stay home and do something else. Like, so if plans change for the future, that's an indicator, especially ones that they were really excited about. Obviously making threats to suicide, verbal or on social media. I think kids can say, I'm not okay, and you know that can be in all lots of ways, on Snapchat or Facebook or Instagram, and there's all these ways you can kind of now not have to tell someone's face, because that might feel a little too hard, but I'm going to maybe put something out there and hope someone hears and sees me. Or like if you see a preoccupation in art, like they're expressing themselves through story or they're drawing things or they find that stuff, they're interested, they're drawn to it, then that's, you kind of want to pay attention to that. And their mood, they're going to be irritable, up and down, hopeless, apathetic, things that they normally enjoy are no longer enjoyable. That's a good indicator. And I would say in my limited experience, that people make attempts not when they're at their absolute lowest. They're just too tired, honestly. They're tired, they're numb, they don't have the energy to do anything about it. But when they start to feel a little bit better, that's when I still get, they're still really depressed, but now they have a little bit more energy. In that little phase, I get most nervous because now they have enough energy to go do something about it. So I don't know if that's helpful, but I would say sometimes when people are so depressed, they don't feel like it because they just sit there and do nothing. Okay, behavior. Well, they might start using substances more, acting reckless, isolating, eating and sleeping too much, too little, lack of hygiene. They start, self-care goes out the window. Why shower? I don't even care. So they, performance in normally done well activities like school or work, you know, that's going to deteriorate. They're not going to care to put the effort in. They maybe aren't showing up to work. So when grades drop, to me with a teenager, if your kid's grades are dropping, and that's, you got to pay attention. Something's going on. Let's see. Visiting, calling, saying goodbye. You called so-and-so? What? Like, why? Well, they might be saying goodbye. Giving away stuff? That's another one. Okay, so Alita, what do I do? Let's try to spend some time about, like, what to do a little bit about these things. Well, pray, honestly, like, the whole time. You got to pray. And to remember that the Lord is a part of this and that he is the ultimate comforter. And we need him for wisdom and support. And teenagers, you kind of, it's kind of like veterinary medicine, right? They're not going to probably tell you that they have cancer, but, you know, dogs can't speak and a lot of times kids won't speak. So you kind of have to pay attention to what they're doing. So you think your dog's not okay because they're sleeping in a weird place in the house. Same with your kid. If they're sleeping in a weird place in your house, pay attention to that. And assume that they're minimizing their struggle. Teens, again, are trying to balance exploration, right? They're trying to do their life. They're trying to do their own thing. They want to stay connected. And so they're just, you may not get a verbal, accurate picture about what's going on. So pay attention to their actions. Pay attention to what's going on in their world. Okay, what to do? Well, I would say, what I'm going to say is not really geared to out-of-control kids. This is geared towards having conversations with kids who are being teenagers. Yeah.
What's the difference between out-of-control?
High substance user, running away, in and out of juvie. Does that make sense? Okay. So I would say that with teens, you want to make sure if you're going to talk to them, you want them to be a customer to what you're selling. I know that sounds really crazy, but they can sit there and you can talk, but if they're not really open to what you have to say, they're not buying what you're selling. So I would say lecturing doesn't work and advice giving doesn't work. And if they go, all right, that's a no, let's be honest, probably. And I would say connection to your kids, I think, is the most important thing, honestly. Like, if you have a good relationship, that is going to help them through a lot. Think connection before direction. If you have a struggled relationship with your kid, they are not going to listen to you. You're off the list. And so you want to work to try to get back on that list to having influence. Because really, if you think about it, okay, what do I want most from my teens? I want influence. I want them to see me as an advocate, a team member, someone who has wisdom, who messed up and tried to figure things out and have something to give, right? And that you would want that from me? Like, honestly, like, you can't put baby in a corner. I mean, my kids are 6 foot whatever, and they could carry me out the door if they wanted to. But I want to have influence in their lives. And that comes as a privilege that is earned. And what do our kids want? They want freedom. They want to go do stuff, right? And all of that is based in trust. And if they don't trust us, they're not going to tell us a thing. And if we don't trust them, we're not giving the car keys to them, right? Why? So you want to stay connected and you want to be able to build trust. So think connection before direction. And I would say these issues have to be talked about. And in order to talk about that, I would recommend that you don't engage in spontaneous conversation about these issues. Probably they're not going to be open to it, right? They're on their phone and you're all, hey, just checked your grades, or what, I found pot in your drawer. Like, don't do that. They're going to be defensive. They're not going to be a customer. You have to talk about them, but not probably in that moment. So I would make an appointment. Let them know I want to talk to you. Give them a chance to like rally a little bit. They might be a little bit more open than just dropping something on them at the last minute. Kids need encouragement. If they don't want your advice, then encourage them. Speak to the person you believe God can make them in their future. Talk to them as if they're going to, that person, those nuggets of who you are in there, that's the person I'm going to talk to like. I want someone in my life to say, oh, okay, you can make it, Alita. I believe that you're that person that God's growing you to be. And I think, again, because kids are struggling with identity, if they know that their parents believe the best in them, that person that they can kind of go, yeah, I don't know, I'm not quite there yet. But my mom and dad think that, they're going to feel cared for and loved. And that'll be encouraging. And you might say things like, I believe that you'll know when to ask for help. You know, I know you don't really want to talk to me. I know you don't want to really tell me what's going on. But I believe that you know when it gets to a certain point, I'm here for you, and then you'll ask for help. Or you'll go to someone else. Say things like, I trust that you have good head on your shoulders and that you'll figure it out and that I'm here. Okay. But kids need limits too, right? Because their brains aren't working. They need an external brake system that says, maybe that's not a good idea. And they learn over time, developmentally, to self-govern, right? Kids put things in their mouth, and it just happens, right? Well, I guess teens do that too, right? They're like two-year-olds, but in adolescence, right? Still trying things out. But they slowly learn how to say no because they want to say no, but not because the world is saying to say no. That's what we want to do, is kids internalize a good sense of who they are and making decisions regardless of what's on the outside in an internal locus of control. It's not based on the, I don't have any pot, so I'm not smoking pot. It's, I'm not going to smoke pot, regardless if my mom or dad know or whatever, because that's who I want to be. So they're going to need help. And I would say limits, we want to think about accountability and discipline more so that it's corrective than punitive. Because punitive just says, I win. I've got all the control. There's not a lot of learning in that. We want kids to figure out what didn't go well and how to do it differently, right? And you need to see that they know the answers to that. You need to see that they blew it and they know how to get out of that situation, because that builds the trust. So just taking their phone away, just taking their car keys away, that just puts everything on pause, and feelings might descend, you know, like chill out a little bit, and they're at home all the time, but do you really trust them yet? No. You both need a way out of that situation. They need to learn, and you need to see that they know what to do differently. So think about accountability being more corrective than punitive. Let's see. And the more consistent you can be, and the more clear that you, if you do this, this is what's going to happen. You're going to have to come up with a plan, and I'm going to hold you accountable to that plan. And you got an F on your physics test. Well, that's not going to fly. What are you going to do about it? Not call your teacher, make sure you, they're teenagers. They need to come up with the plan so that when they go off to college or wherever they're going to go, they take that information experience with them. So these conversations are really important between parents and kids. And I would say an over-controlling parent will always get fired. They're going to fire you in a hot second. So you managing your own emotion, you taking time to, if you have a spouse or a co-parent, to talk to them too on how to deal with these big issues, it's really important that you're in a good spot. Because remember, your kids' brains are crazy. So if you enter in crazy, right? It's like an explosion. Okay, so what to do more specifically about these hard issues? Okay, you gotta have the conversation. And most likely, you might find information not directly from them, right? You find a razor blade, you see a scar, you find drugs in their underwear when you put them away. Someone tells you something, you gotta be honest. I think secret keeping is not a good idea. I think that if you wanna build trust, you have to be honest. And it won't be easy, but I think it's better to start with honesty and end with honesty. So make an appointment, and then while you're having some time for yourself too, get together with your spouse, your co-parent, pray, take time to pray, get yourself in a good spot. And I would say the parent that's most bonded to the kid will have the best results from this conversation. So if you know you're like one of you is kind of not in a good spot with them right now, you know, because sometimes, you know, your attachment and closeness depends on how they're doing, and maybe one of you is just not in a good spot, you're kind of butting heads, it's best that you're not that person to have the conversation. So pick the person who's most bonded, and you got the appointment, and really start calmly. Start with concerns. And hopefully you've already kind of dealt with some of your fear that you have that can get us to say and do things that are not most effective. And you can say, I'm concerned, how are you doing? I found this. Be honest, share how you felt, and really try to listen, and don't interrupt. Sometimes a lot of questions in this, depending, can be good or not good. They might be open, you kind of have to read them to see if they're a customer to this moment, and if they're open to questions, then it's good to ask. But questions can shut down kids. So you just kind of, that's a nuance that you got to have to kind of figure out. And I would say that when you're talking about like safety issues, like say you're a house that's safe and you've got a kid that's come in and they're talking to you about something, and they don't promise confidentiality or be prepared to break it, right? Because you might have a kid who comes in and you don't know, you're just like out on the back deck eating a burger and they tell you, you know, I've really been depressed lately and I've got pills in my car and I'm just, after I leave, I'm gonna. Well, if you say, well, and then they don't tell anyone, please don't tell anyone. Like, you let them be mad at you. Like, mad and alive is so much better, right? Let's just look at the options. And they might be upset and yell and scream and punish you for that, but that's, you gotta be able to take that on. And if it's really hard because you feel like you have a rift now in this relationship, like, you gotta take care of yourself too. Because it's hard. Like, I don't, as a clinician, I don't like doing certain things at all. But I know that that's what's in their best interest. And I know that sometimes they get pissed and they don't come back or they, whatever. But that's okay. That's a part of it. Okay, and so when you're talking to them, think about that use addiction continuum. Because that will help you go, oh, well, I found pot, but... Or you discover something, you want to kind of be able to gauge. Is this like a one-time thing? Or is this a happening all the time thing? You got to be able to kind of know where they sit in that. And depending on that, depends on what you do, which we don't have time for, sorry. Okay. So let's talk about what to do about suicide. One thing about self-harm is showing someone their scars or their cuts can be very vulnerable and shameful. Like, they think you think they're crazy already. So showing you those things may be too vulnerable. It would help to know how bad it is, but you kind of want to be invited into that. So I guess I caution you around having them show you their injuries. Okay, on to suicide. So basically, you want to, if you know your teen is really struggling, is to check in and say, you know, you're having this conversation and they seem really down, and I think you just gotta ask, have you ever thought about taking your own life? You just gotta do it. You gotta just say it. And they might say no, and then they just say, but I just kind of wish Jesus would just say, come on home. Well, that's called suicidal ideation. That is not, that's a little bit different. That's thoughts of suicide, not plans of suicide. But still, you want to comfort them. You want to draw near to them, maybe make sure they're not alone. Make sure they get help. Try to get them to a counselor. And check in with them. Now, if they say, yeah, if I've thought about killing myself, then you got to ask what their plan is. It's really important to know what that plan is, because that plan will tell you what to do. So you want to assess two things around a plan: lethality and accessibility. I had to do this on the phone last night with a client. She called out of desperation, and I needed to try to figure out what was your plan. And you want to try to get information as much as they're willing to tell you, whether it's pills or something else. You want to know that whatever that is, if it's highly lethal, that we want to figure out a plan to get it away from them as much as possible, right? And how accessible is it? So worst case scenario, someone's on their bed with a gun. That is the most lethal, most accessible, right? So we want to get them away from it, and we want to make sure they get what they need. So you want to eliminate accessibility and come up with a safety plan to keep them safe until you can get them to the help that they need. And it's going to be more than you, and that's okay. Please don't feel like you have to be the person. You need to get them to the right people. Sometimes it's helpful to help them think about reasons why we still want them here, reasons they have to stay alive, reasons that people who love them, things that they want to accomplish, things that attach them to life. Help them see those things, because they're not seeing those things. And it might be you have to take them to an emergency room to keep them safe, or to call hotline numbers first and then get them there. And so people, I don't know your stories in dealing with people like this in your life, whether you're a teacher or you've got family members that are struggling. I really encourage you to take care of yourself. These are ongoing, enduring issues. And it's easy to feel helpless and overwhelmed because they're hard. So you taking care of you is really important, right? It's like you feel like this person is drowning and you jump in the deep end and you kind of know how to swim, or you're injured, and so it makes you rescuing them more difficult. So if you're on the front lines, if you have people who are struggling, I really encourage you to reach out, let people know you're struggling so that you're not doing this alone. Oh my gosh, I have time for questions. Really happy about that. Okay. I know that's a lot of information. Yeah, question.
Thanks for you already answered one of the questions that you asked, which are like, what are the things novice does with people, the biggest mistakes people make? So I appreciated that. Thank you for covering so much ground. It's a short period of time.
Yeah.
I have a question about suicide.
Yes.
It has to do with age.
Okay.
And I'm curious whether you like calibrate the response depending on the age of the person. Like, if someone's like 18 and they're talking about suicide, do you take that more seriously than somebody who's like 10?
I would say take it all very seriously. I mean, I think an 18-year-old has probably more accessibility to things and potentially lethal things because they're a legal adult. But I would say, no, kids can take a jump rope in their closet. I am sorry, that's gross, but it's possible. So I would say even a young kid, you know, I'd want that kid at 10 to get that help instead of waiting until they're 18 and, you know, acting out more. So I'd say, yeah. But good question. So yeah, take serious everything about suicide, no matter what the age. Yeah.
Do you feel like what you've seen over the last probably 10 years, that social media and kids' accessibility to phones and social media has caused an increase in self-harm and substance abuse?
Yeah, the internet's a crazy thing, huh? I mean, I would want Donnie to maybe weigh in if she has a...
I was kind of hoping.
Okay, I will. I've just recently read a couple books just about teenagers in general, and they are more depressed and anxious than any other generation. And actually, statistically, screens increase depending on the type of interaction. Like, I think social media has the most negative impact on mood. And the study took 10 different activities and wanted to see impact on mood. And everything connected to screens had an impact negatively. And even things like work and homework had a positive influence on mood. So when they complained about homework, no. But I think it does. I think they have accessibility to a lot of things that then become options in their mind. So, yeah. Ooh, yeah, go ahead.
I think what was our last question? I think that they have an epidemic of inadequate sleep across the population. If you're ever lighted or not, and enlightened.
Mm-hmm, that's true. Yeah.
For teenagers, I mean, I think that the biology is the brain is like a hybrid car.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so if the biology is, if the brain is not restored,
mm-hmm. Sleep is a big thing.
Mm-hmm. If you want to make anybody crazy, deprive them of sleep.
Yes, that's huge.
Back to the teenager, and we have light from the light bulbs and so forth. We also have lights from all the screens.
Mm-hmm.
It's an epidemic for young people.
Yes.
For the whole world, actually.
Yeah, I would just, recording, he made a comment about how the screens affect our sleep and gets in the way of our getting our restoration that needs to happen in the brain. And we're not getting enough sleep, too. They're going to bed late. If I can tell you, just like the kids' phones need to be plugged in the kitchen when they go to bed. And screens need to be done a half an hour before, just so that your brain can slowly calm down. And I think our teens are not sleeping enough. And then they're using, I need it as an alarm. Buy them an alarm. Just get the phone out of their house or their room. Yeah. The bullying.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you want to read more kind of about this generation, Jean Twing, I don't know if that's how you say her name, but she's a professor at San Diego State, and she basically does research on teenagers and patterns of generations. She did one on called Generation Me that was Gen X, and then she has a new one called the iGen Generation, and it revolves around the iPhone, and really interesting statistics that affect our kids today. Yeah.
Okay, so you made a comment that children are alcoholics are four times more likely at risk.
Mm-hmm.
What if you're in, like, you're a parent and you're in recovery and they've never seen you drink? Are they still more likely at risk?
Yeah.
And so if you have two parents.
Yep. So yes, yeah, you get your beautiful looks. Your daughter, I bet, has got your beautiful face, and if you're have had past issues, she's got the brain too. So you just want to educate. That's the thing, is just educate them. It doesn't necessarily mean that they will, but it's really important for them to have that information so they can make good decisions for themselves. They may decide it's not worth it. And the hard thing is that teens, again, I'll let my future self deal with that. Sort of decisions, you know, I'll worry about that and study in the morning or whatever. But information, I think, is helpful. I don't know, what do we got? Oh, we're out of time. If you have to go get kids or whatever, I'll hang out, but feel free to take off.